I'll bring this meeting of the Hess Committee together today. It's February 10th. It is 3:20. We've got three bills to work on today. Before we get started, please, I'd ask everyone to shut off their cell phones. And I'd like to remind the committee that if you need to cough or anything, push your button first, because if anybody is testifying at that same time, they don't hear it. Whatever they were saying gets lost in the microphone. I would like to state for the record that let the record show that Seaton and McGuire were already excused by the speaker, and the ones present are Anderson, Gardner, Cisna, and myself, Wilson. And Rep. Coring called, and he wanted to make sure that I mentioned four things: that he apologizes, he'll be a little late, but he'll be there as soon as he can because he just flew in on an airplane. So anyway, he will be here shortly, I would imagine. Okay, on the agenda today, we have House Bill, we're going to try to do three bills today. We're going to have a public testimony on 105 and 106, but we're going to do the Public Health Disaster and Emergencies first, which is House Bill 95. And I guess, is it Dr. Monsauger? Is he? Yeah, he's here, and he's going to present the bill to us on public health disasters and emergencies. So Dr. Monsauger, if you would go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson. I'm Dick Monsauger. It's a pleasure to be here again, and thanks for the willingness to entertain this bill today. Since we've talked some about public health and preparedness at previous hearings, I'm going to try not to talk about what we've talked about at previous hearings as background, and we'll try and move forward.
Oh, and I might want to mention that I went ahead, as I do most bills when I get them, I quote and send them over to Ledge Legal over there to see if there's anything in the bill that might need something that they scrutinize a little bit harder. They did send me some things. I met with the department, and we're going to make some changes, and so we've got a four amendments, and as we go along, Dr. Monsauger, if you will just explain those as we go along, we'll kind of stop and vote on them and then go forward.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay. So what I would like to do in the next 10 minutes or so as an introduction is very briefly review public health in the background, review the problems with the current statutes, include a brief overview of elements of the proposed bill, and then as a subtext to that, comment on the Ledge Legal memo with our perspectives and some suggested amendments, and then I'm available to answer questions too, if that's okay. So the next slide, you have slides in front of you again like we did last time. It has a quote from the Institute of Medicine: public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. What we're going to be talking about mostly today is the governmental part of the public health system. And I think it's important to just put in context that public health system is a partnership of government, of individuals, of nonprofits and communities, of municipal governments, and other levels of government too. And just as background again, as I think about the contributions of the governmental part of the public health system in our country over the last 150 years, as a physician, it seems to me the most significant undertaking in our country was the institution of sewage removal and treatment in cities that started in the 1800s. And then shortly thereafter, provision of safe water began being instituted throughout cities. In the post-World War II era, the world that I know, protection from vaccine-preventable diseases. As a pediatrician, that's a part of the public health that I really know well. In more recent decades, clean indoor air is a part of the governmental action. And then also, if we think back a couple of decades, to taking lead out of gasoline to prevent lead poisoning, we don't often think that work over there is really related to public health, but taking lead out of gasoline was a governmental action that has significantly impacted health. The next slide, I think, again, is a context. It's important to remember that public health is not healthcare. We're talking today about the focus on populations, not individuals primarily. We're talking on prevention primarily, not treatment. And government's unique role in this, it's legal obligations to prevent disease, disability, injury, and illness among populations. We talked the previous times I've been here about some examples, immunizations to prevent vaccine-preventable diseases, PPDs in our state with TB. We do regularly with lots of people, with kids, with teachers, and so on. Injury prevention, just a quick story. The logging industry here in Southeast Alaska is looking at data. There were a lot of people getting hurt in transportation in vehicles on logging roads. Well, the first step was epidemiology. What kind of accidents, where are they occurring? Next is what kind of vehicles? Can we change the vehicles? Can we change the training? Are there other safety practices? And that partnership between government and industry has significantly reduced those kinds of accidents that largely impacts here in Southeast Alaska. It's just a story. I think about the public health governmental system as a lot of analogies to fire departments in the background, that if we train with small outbreaks, we're pretty invisible if the job is done right, but it's important to always be prepared and trained and in the background for when we're needed. Since we've talked a lot about preparedness before, I'm not going to talk too much about that. I'm going to bridge now over to the bill itself and to remember that we do have good surveillance in place, as we talked about the oyster story out of Prince William Sound last time. We have much better laboratory testing capability since 911 as a part of our preparedness mission. But there are weaknesses, and that's what we're talking about today. The inadequate legal authorities that are addressed in the proposal that's before you in HB 95, the inadequate laboratory facility for virology, HB 100, that'll be considered by another committee, our dependence on federal funds I had commented on before, and then the stress on staff to be able to both prepare and to deliver services every day as a competing priorities that is every day hard, but is important that we do both. A slide that has some pictures, old public health enemies, pictures of polio, pictures of influenza. The picture there with the people in the masks is back from 1918 with the flu pandemic that affected so many people back then. The kids in braces from the polio days in the early 50s, and TB sanatorium picture there on the right. Traditional disease control, as we've talked about before, includes the tools of quarantine and isolation. Isolation if somebody is sick, quarantine if somebody may have been exposed, or we're waiting to find out if they are sick or if they need treatment. Well, those have been traditional tools for infectious disease and continue to be important, and those are buried in this bill as to what authorities government has, hopefully to use rarely, but needs to have available when needed. The next slide talks about the next SARS. We talked before about in 2003, the legislature was in session, thankfully. There was a possibility of SARS coming to Alaska. The legislature amended our current statute to give us the authority to quarantine or isolate if we needed to for SARS. But it's not a good way to do business to depend on the legislature to be in session when some new disease shows up in state. And these days we worry a lot about something called avian flu. In Southeast Asia, it's now become endemic in the poultry and duck and other bird population in Southeast Asia. It's very virulent and lethal, about a 70% mortality rate in Southeast Asia in the last couple of years. Thankfully, it's not very transmissible human to humans. It's mostly from birds to humans and people that live in close proximity. In the last 3 months, though, there have been the World Health Organization has reported the first three cases of possible human-to-human transmission. If this mutates and becomes transmissible, it's a bad disease, and we need to be prepared. So I would argue that it's both the right thing to do, that we need to update our statutes, and it's also the ethical thing to do, that we need to be prepared as a community. And it's about balance. It's about balance between the mission to protect public health and the mission or the obligation for individuals to have due process rights if government overreaches. And that's the balance we're trying to achieve in this statute, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So the next slide talks about the problem is that our laws are old. The basic statutes date from territory days. They've been amended twice, 1995 and 2003, once for TB and once for SARS, but are not generalizable in the current understanding of the courts. Now, we might get lucky, and a judge might construe that we have broad authorities and give us the right to quarantine or isolate if we need to, but it's not a good policy that we should go forward depending on different judicial interpretations in different courts for how to proceed. So this is a set of laws that is old. It stood us pretty well, but needs to be updated. So what's in the proposal that's before you? It's a framework that brings up to date the current understandings of public health, a mission, services, and role. It gives clear authority for the control for conditions of public health importance and defines that term, because that's really the essence of what the governmental part of the public health system does. And it provides modern due process provisions for the protection of individual rights. And as I said, this whole discussion, which I'm glad we're engaged in, is about balance. It's about how do we do both in a way that is appropriate. And I hope that we have some conversation about that as we go forward here over the next few minutes. So HB 95 is an act relating to public health. It defines the essential public health services. That's based on accepted definitions from the U.S. Public Health Functions Task Force. It's based on work from the Institute of Medicine twice over the last 15 years. This proposal describes the state's role in protection and promotion of the public's health, provides clear authority for control of conditions of public health importance through the tools of surveillance, epidemiologic investigation, treatment, quarantine, and isolation. Now, we tend to think about this bill mostly in terms of infectious disease, but I want to tell a couple news stories from this past year that have to do with non-infectious disease. One is a story from Kivalina from last summer. You may remember in the papers, some of the papers of the state, there were some articles about possible lead contaminating subsistence foods up in the Kivalina area in the Red Dog Mine corridor coming from the mine. And there was a lot of discussion about that. Were people at risk? The industry has changed a lot since the mine opened. They cover as the ore comes out of the mine. And the evidence in the past has been that this kind of lead is not very absorbable. Well, with the controversy last summer, once the summer was done, we'd worked through the summer with CDC and arranged a partnership to offer testing to people that wanted to get tested in those villages in that corridor this fall, and did that about Thanksgiving time. And once again, there was very little to no lead above the level of 10, which is the concern level. As I recall, there was one person at 10 or 11. Everybody else was below. But this is a partnership between the community and public health that we were able to offer the community to reassure them that it was safe and to lay groundwork for the future. I personally think, this is my own personal opinion, that community should be offered the opportunity several times in the decades to come whenever the time is right to be retested. Another public health function out of the villages of Ambler this past year. There wasn't any construction in Ambler last summer because asbestos was found in the gravel being used for construction in that community. Well, so what does one do? Is that asbestos dangerous? There aren't any standards for asbestos outdoors. What happens with the dust flying around? We wrestled with that question because of concern. There was no construction in that community last summer. The airport expansion was stopped, school construction was stopped, and so we've been working with the community and trying to find out best advice around the world. So what we did this fall is adults who lived in the community a long time were asked if they would voluntarily provide copies of their x-rays. We sent them to an expert outside. There are four individuals that have some scarring that may be evidence of asbestos. Now they're going back and talking with those four individuals. What was their occupational history? Had they worked other places? To try and develop this spring now in cooperation with the community, what should be the appropriate control measures, if anything, in that community. I tell these stories just as an example of non-infectious disease work that the governmental part of public health is important to the communities in our state. Finally, this act will strengthen the confidentiality and security of records. We feel strongly that we depend really on voluntary provision of data. Some of it is identifiable to people, and we have a big responsibility to the public to protect that data and that it's kept in a confidential and secure manner, and the current statutes are not very clear about what our responsibilities are about that. So the act really has five different parts. Next slide. One is the purpose and intent in Section 1, administration of public health laws by the department, Sections 4, 5, and 7, public health authority and powers in 8, legal representation and court powers 9, 10, and 11, and then some general provisions in 2, 3, 6, 12, and 13. I mostly want to talk about, on the next slide, Sections 1, 2, and 3. And then we'll open it up for questions in a few minutes. Purpose and intent, it's really to protect and promote the health of the citizens of this state to the greatest extent possible. It's not intended to mandate provision of certain services. Administration of public health law, you can see the bullets there. We've talked about that, to modernize and clarify the public health powers, clarify the nature of regulations for reporting, define the definition of conditions of public health importance. And then the powers and authority is really around the infectious disease part, around quarantine, isolation, treatment. A comment I'd make about treatment, if you've looked at the bill, you'll see that it talks about we can mandate screening and testing, but not treatment. Why, one might think? The Model Act we tested our statutes against includes treatment in it. As we've thought about the question, it's important, the mission of public health is to protect the health of the community. So once somebody is found to have an infectious disease, the person really then has a choice. They can choose to stay isolated, or they can choose to get treated. It shouldn't be our job to say you have to take a medicine when there might be side effects or something. The person should enter into it. We should have to be a dialogue with the individual. So as part of the personal choice, this proposal you have in front of you would leave the treatment as a possibility that the person decides, rather than us deciding you must take this medicine or you must take that, have that treatment course. It's one of the balance points about what's the government's role and what's the individual's role. I think the other thing about quarantine and isolation, it's important to stay, is it's used very, very rarely. In the last decade, we've only had to think about using it twice. I talked with a person who was a health director in Idaho with a population a lot larger, and they were doing it about once a year with a population much larger, proportionally probably about the same type of incidence. Most people will cooperate voluntarily, but one needs a tool in the background for the rare condition in which one needs it. The next slide then refers to the alleged legal memo. So as we read the memo and thought about it, there are 7 different points raised in it. And the first one is sufficient notice provided in the due process provisions? In our view, the provisions in the bill strike a fair balance between individual rights and public protection. The notice, if somebody is ordered to do something, you aren't going to test somebody unless they've had notice of what it is you're doing, why you're doing it. It seems implicit to us that that would be true. Number 2, why is refusal of medical treatment allowed? I already talked about that, about what's the role of public health, what's the role of individual health, that medical treatment is a decision that a person has to make. They have to think about their own side effects and so on, and then judge whether they want to stay isolated and so they don't infect anybody else or be treated. Why no criminal penalties? The bill calls for only civil contempt proceedings, not criminalization, because, one, we think it's going to be used very infrequently, and two, if people don't cooperate, it's not going to be out of criminal intent. It's going to be an ordinary situation. It's going to be out of fear. And it doesn't seem right to us that we would criminalize that process. Our access to medical records provisions.
Just a second, Dr. Yeah. Monsacher. For you, what we're talking about is behind tab 1, and also behind the fiscal note is the memorandum from Ledge Legal. And Representative Anderson had a question.
No, I didn't. It was a wave to my staff.
Oh.
But I didn't interrupt you.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Feel free to interrupt.
Okay, I'm sorry, Dr. Monsacher. Okay. Go ahead.
I got a lot of things.
Are access to medical record provision HIPAA compliant? The answer is yes, in our view, that is. Is an indirect court rule amendment made by this bill? Now, this is a legal question. If you have questions, you'll have to talk to Dan Branch, who's here from Department of Law. But we agree that yes, an amendment is proposed.
Okay, now why don't we, this is kind of a little kittywampus the way we're doing this today, but we're going to do it this way anyway. So would someone like to move that we bring the House Bill 95 before us.
I move House, we don't have a CS at this time.
No, we don't.
No, I move House Bill 95. Procedurally, is that necessary? I don't think it is, unless it's a CS.
Yeah, you're probably
You've called
right.
it before, yeah. So I think we're good.
Yeah, you're probably right on that. Okay, so anyway, you have the proposed amendment to fix that part of it that we're just talking about. And this is the sufficient notice?
This would be A.2.
Yeah, and this is sufficient notice. You're adding the...
The question was asked in the Ledge Legal Memo whether an indirect court rule amendment is needed. The Department of Law concurs that it probably is, and the amendment that's been proposed by Jean Michelle is A.2.
A.2. So look at your amendments and pull out A.2.
And I think it's filed in your file backwards. We had anticipated getting into it last rather than first.
So this will be number one, amendment number one. And that, actually, looking at this list, which one is it?
It is the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth bullet.
It's an indirect court rule amendment made by this bill. It says, is an indirect court rule amendment.
Needed is probably the right word by this bill.
And you're agreeing with Ledge Legal and saying, yes, it is.
Correct.
And so this corrects that.
Yes.
Does anybody have...
you want me to move that?
Yes, would you please?
Okay, then, Madam Chair, regarding House Bill 95, I move Amendment 1, label it 1, and it would be referred to for reference for the record as 24-GH1002/A.2 from Jean Michelle from Legal Services. But Amendment 1 is what?
Right. Okay. Do you, are there any questions? Does everyone understand that? Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, the amendment number 1 has passed. Okay, then we'll go on.
Then the next bullet says, why are parents deprived party status in quarantine isolation hearings? This question started coming up early this week, and we scratched our heads and said, why had we put it in the bill? This is, and we concur with Ledge Legal that that was an error and should be corrected. We never intended to remove parent rights from the processes, and... That amendment?
G1.
G1.
24G1.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, thank you. I move Amendment 2, which would be labeled 24G-1 for the members, from the members' packet, and that references what?
No, that's not.
Is that
that's not correct. That's a
guardian ad litem? Then I retract and withdraw my Amendment Number 2. Bad Amendment Number 2.
Okay.
I don't have a copy of that amendment.
Oh.
You know, we may have to refer to the bill. Did we have this one written? Yes.
It's on this one with the...
There's two together. I didn't look at that. Dan just pointed out to me. If you look at A.1, there are two amendments buried in there together.
Okay.
If you look at A.1, at line 10... That answers this bullet, is really to delete the section that says, however, parents or guardians of the minor do not have party status in the proceedings under this section. It would remove that.
Madam Chair, I can, since I withdrew the other, with your indulgence, I can help.
So, oh, I see.
Since I withdrew Amendment Number 2, hence there is no Amendment Number 2 in existence, I can make a motion again for Amendment Number 2. But to do that, I would like to have the committee members recognize that this will be a conceptual amendment because I'm bifurcating or splitting, as the doctor said, A.1. So in the process of this motion, does everyone have A.1 before them? It looks everyone's shaking their head. So what I'd like to do is, it has to be conceptual because it's not verbatim on this sheet. It would be conceptual amendment number 2, and the secretary will note that it is page 15, line 16, deleting minor, quote, minor, comma, however, comma, parents or guardians of the minor do not have party status in the proceedings under this section, end of quote, and then inserting minor. and I think legal services will understand that, and that would address your problem, and that would be amendment number two. Conceptual amendment number two.
Okay. Any objections? Hearing no objections, that has passed. And then, since we bifurcated this, we'll go on and pick up the other part later.
And the last bullet that was in that memo is, and this table asked the question, is shared jurisdiction with DEC in cases involving contaminated material and public health disaster addressed. We had a lot of conversation in drafting this bill with Department of DMVA, which is where the major authorities are for in a disaster situation. And the bill that's in front of you is the result of the discussions between DHSS and DMVA, that the authorities for a public health disaster, the primary authorities would be clearly identified with DHSS. And that's why it's written as it is, with contaminated material or infectious waste put together under DHSS responsibility. Clearly, we can't predict what kind of a public health disaster would have, and whatever the material is or whatever the disaster is, there would clearly be partnership between DEC, DHSS, DMVA in terms of dealing with that disaster scenario.
Okay. So we're going to leave the bill like it is, and there was a reason
for
that.
That would be our proposal.
Okay.
And then finally, I just wanted the last slide. Remember, I had this big poster up here first time I was here. Right now, the Trust for America's Health puts Alaska over in the right-hand side as the only state in the country that does not have adequate statutory authority to quarantine in response to a hypothetical bioterrorism attack scenario. So if one thinks, what might that be, it would be smallpox would be the classic example where one needs to respond very, very quickly. And we're the only state in the country that doesn't have broad quarantine and isolation authority to be able to respond in an emergency. And my hope is that by the time this legislative session is done, we don't have to have our state identified there. You want to move to the other two amendments?
Please.
And then, so the amendment you have in front of you that's called 24G1. This is the result. After the governor's bill was introduced, the Office of Public Advocacy hadn't put their comments forward, and this is some concerns they had that is the result of discussions between the Office of Public Advocacy and the Department of Law to clarify their role and relationship to guardian ad litems if minors are involved in one of these quarantine or isolation scenarios.
Does anybody have any questions on that? Not on what Dr. Monsalve was saying. Understand it all? Mm-hmm. Okay. Does someone want to, this would be number three.
Yep.
Amendment number three.
So, Madam Chair, I move, as noted on your versus 24G-1 from Legal Services, and it would be labeled amendment number three regarding the guardian ad litem request.
Okay.
As
any discussion or any objections? Even no objections. So that amendment has passed. Now,
and then the last one is the first half of that bifurcated amendment. Let me give you some background. This came out of Senate Hess, who dealt with this bill yesterday, and the first part, the top part of this page was adopted and amended in Senate Hess yesterday. The background is that Senators Elton and Dyson on the Senate side have been interested in trying to clarify the transportation of dead bodies, that if people have religious reasons that they don't want a body embalmed, that it would be clear that they could choose to transport a body to some other place to be buried without having to be embalmed. And so on the Senate side, there's been a bill pending, and they decided yesterday to try and move in and amend into this bill, since we had an amendment in with the same part of the bill, and move this into this proposed bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number four, again, as referenced, 8.1. Everyone's shaking their head that they understand, and that's the one that's been split, and it's addressing page 1, line 4, and page 6, line 17, as articulated by the doctor. And
Dr. Mossbacher?
Could I make one comment before you vote?
Sure.
We have not finished carefully reviewing all of the state interstate statutes. We think this works okay with federal, subject to federal authorities and so on. But on the Senate side, they agreed that as we finish researching this in the next couple of weeks, if there are problems with this, that we could enter back into the further committees that this bill would undergo. We think this is okay, but it happened so fast yesterday, the careful study isn't finished yet, and we need to do that.
And we are trying to do this so that we saves time in the process. So.
And Madam Chair, just with that, with the discussion, and let's say I objected, so we can discuss it. With that objection, the bill goes next to judiciary, and I believe it does.
I think it does, yes.
And so it's prudent, I think, for you to do what you're doing for expeditious reasons, and we can go ahead and address it there, and I'm on judiciary, and so is Representative McGuire and Groomberg and Guerin, so we can go through that and find out and get maybe a...
We'll have an answer before then.
Perfect.
Good.
So I remove my objection.
Okay.
To my motion.
The objection removed, then we this amendment has passed. So hopefully we do have some people online that would like to give their testimony, but hopefully the things that we've done in this bill right now will hopefully alleviate some of the concerns that maybe some of the people online have. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify further on this bill? Okay. Then I have online with the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, Michael McLeod Ball. Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Thank you, Representative Wilson and members of the committee for allowing me to offer input on this important bill. I'd also like to thank Dr. Mansager, who brought this bill to my attention a few weeks back. He and I have not been able to meet to discuss the bill. We talked briefly this past Monday, but we're scheduled to meet again tomorrow morning, and I hope to talk with him in some detail about some of our concerns about the bill. His effort to seek us out and solicit our input, I think, reflects the sincerity of his comments to the Senate yesterday and to you folks today when he spoke of the need to find a balance between the public health needs and our desire to preserve our individual freedoms under the U.S. and Alaska constitutions. By the very nature of this bill, it contemplates that individual Alaskans will give up some of their personal freedoms and permit the government to intrude on their privacy under certain circumstances. We agree that under some of the dire circumstances cited by the administration, that such restrictions may be appropriate. Our concern with this bill, however, is that, as drafted, it contemplates giving the government the right to quarantine and isolate individuals and to inspect and retain private medical records in circumstances not nearly so dire as the examples cited. We do not oppose the intent of this bill. Rather, we seek to limit the circumstances when the government can exercise those intrusions on our liberty and privacy solely to those dire emergencies that demand extraordinary government action to preserve our society. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union believes we can be both safe and free. We have not presented a section-by-section analysis of this bill so that we can meet with Dr. Mansager and talk about our concerns, and we're scheduled to meet tomorrow morning, as I said. After that, I would hope we would be able to provide you with some specific suggestions to perhaps improve this bill and preserve some of those individual freedoms. I would like to talk about four broad areas, if I could, where our concerns exist. First, we believe the government's right to quarantine or isolate an individual against his or her will or to access that individual's private medical records should only exist in the very narrowest set of limited circumstances. As written, we believe the right to access identifiable private medical records and to quarantine or isolate an individual against his or her will is too broad. The department's authority to access records or to quarantine or isolate derives from Section 355, which is on page 7 of the bill. There it states that the department may use the powers set out in the bill, quote, to prevent, control, or ameliorate conditions of public health importance or accomplish other essential public health services and functions, close quote. By our reading, that will give the department the right to impose a quarantine or isolation order on an individual or to access private medical records based on nothing more than routine administrative purposes. The essential public health and services and functions, quote, unquote, is defined in Section 390 and includes a list of routine functions, and that list is not unreasonable in any sense. However, that list of functions should not serve as the basis for the department's exercising its extraordinary authority to quarantine or isolate individuals against their will or to access their private medical records. Instead, that authority should not be triggered except in the most unusual circumstances. The other phrase, quote, conditions of public health importance, which Dr. Mansager referred to earlier, is the key phrase here. If the definition of that phrase were to be very narrow so as to define extreme public health emergencies, then the department's right to use the quarantine and isolation authority would only be available in those extreme cases. Our concern, however, is that the definition of conditions of public health importance is rather broad. You'll find it in Section 390, Sub 2. A condition of public health importance arrives from, quote, a threat to health that is identifiable on an individual or community level and can reasonably be expected to lead to adverse health effects in the community, close quote. Adverse health effects is not defined anywhere in the bill that we saw. By that standard, the department could trigger its ability to restrict individual liberty interests and to invade personal medical privacy in the event, for example, that a minor bug runs through a community without endangering anyone's lives. We do not believe that it is the intent of the department to interpret this bill in this fashion. But the fact remains that the language of the bill as drafted can reasonably and fairly be interpreted in this way. We would strongly recommend that the definition of that term, condition of public health importance, be narrowed to reflect only far more serious public health events, giving due consideration to the nature of the disease, the level of contagion, the means of transmission, and the seriousness of the impact on the individual patient. Our second broad area, the government should be required to affirmatively protect the privacy of identifiable medical records and to destroy such records when no longer needed to address the public health need. We're concerned that the language surrounding the government's right to access and retain identifiable medical records may go too far. In Section 360D, the statute contemplates issuance of regulations to govern the department's access to such private information. The only standard to limit the regulatory scheme is set forth in Section 365, which does mandate that such records be held in confidence. We would prefer a more rigorous set of standards to govern the rulemaking process, including, for example, a specific prohibition on the use of private medical records for any purpose other than those in connection with the disease outbreak or public health crisis, a specific prohibition on the disclosure of such information to anyone other than those public health officials involved in the public health event, the obligation to destroy copies of such records when they are no longer needed, and an affirmative statement that such records could not be used in any civil or criminal proceeding without that individual's consent. Our third broad area of concern, the bill should contain affirmative protections that the affected individuals will not suffer negative impacts in their civil transactions or criminal proceedings due solely to the government's action under its authority. We believe that the law can be improved by adding such affirmative protections as that the quarantine, isolation, or medical records access will have no impact on their housing, employment rights, parental rights, or other civil rights, that the action would have no impact on any civil or criminal proceedings involving that individual, that the individual be compensated for any property taken or lost through the government's exercise of its authority, and that the action does not act to waive the doctor-patient confidentiality and imposes such a restriction on any medical professional that gains access to that information through this process. Our fourth and final broad area of concern has more to do with the procedure side of this. The affected individual should have access to the legal system throughout the process, and the restrictions imposed should be narrowly drawn. We appreciate the efforts of the department to provide a clear process, and though our concerns are significant, it is clear that there is a process available to individuals whose rights have been restricted under this bill. Most of our concerns in the procedural area could be resolved by the following three suggestions. First and foremost, remove the availability of an ex parte proceeding. Section 375 contemplates a proceeding to which the affected individual would have no access. But under the statute, that individual would already have been made aware of the department's concern, and therefore, we don't see the need to bar that person from access to those legal proceedings and taking part in it actively. Secondly, the isolation or quarantine order should include a specific date of termination based upon the projected course of the public health event and that individual's contagiousness or disease. The statute allows an open-ended term up to 30 days, with the individual having the right to challenge. Instead, we believe that the burden should be on the state. The state should have to show how long the order should be in place at the outset, and then put the burden on the state to seek an extension if conditions warrant. And thirdly, under this procedural category, we would like to see that there be a change to and a heightening of the standard for issuing a quarantine or isolation order. As written, the standard for the court is, quote, substantial risk to public health, close quote. I did not see any definition of that particular term. Instead, we would prefer a defined term more closely aligned with the basis for the action. As before, we would like due consideration given to the nature of the condition, the level of contagion, the means of transmission, and the impact on the individual. In short, because this law contemplates placing restrictions on individual liberty, and because it contemplates granting the government access to someone's most private records, the closest scrutiny is required. For each element of this bill, we would ask the committee to ask the following four questions. Is there a compelling state interest? Is the state action targeted narrowly? Is the state action the least restrictive it could be in both time and scope? And does the individual have an effective right to object before imposition of the restrictions? If each of these questions can be answered in the affirmative, then the bill will be better than in its current form. We look forward to working with both the department and the committee to fashion a bill that allows Alaska to remain both safe and free. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. And this is Wilson, the chair, speaking.
Yes, ma'am.
I want you to know that it sounds to me like those are common sense things that we need to be concerned about. But this committee really is looking at the policy. And the reason it has a judicial hearing also is to kind of cover the very things that you're talking about. And so what we're going to do is we're going to pass it out of this committee today, not doing that, because I know that you're meeting with Dr. Monsager on this and that you will the bill will be scrutinized very closely in judiciary. So I thank you for your comments, and we'll do have a couple of comments from other members. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony, and I concur with you on your points 1 and 2. I'm not sure about 3 and 4, especially 3. But on 1 and 2, and all 4 of your comments and subcategories to those, if you could submit those to us after you have the meeting tomorrow, myself as a member of Judiciary, but I think the Hess members would like that even after it passes out of the committee, and then certainly Judiciary members. In to parallel what you said, on page 8, there was lines 9 and 10 state on data collection, that's subsection 4 of 1815-360, that the department is authorized to collect any other data needed to accomplish or further the mission or goals of public health or provide essential public health services and functions. And I think that's illustrative, and I mean, maybe not intentional, but of how broad this is. And of course, you know, as legislators, we need to analyze the public policy benefit, and that's really broad, because what's the definitive nature of this data? Well, it just says any other data. And I think the testifier mentioned a lot of different sections where that's, we might have to constrain it. And his constitutional standards, I think the 4 he read at the end, does each section meet that? I think that's an important one for us to weigh here mentally as it comes to the floor and in judiciary. So I'm glad he testified.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much. I was going to thank the caller, Mike, for his comments and ask for written copies as well.
Yeah, that would be really great. If you could go ahead and fax that to us, we'd appreciate it.
I'm sorry, are you asking to fax my testimony today?
Yes.
Yes, I have that right here.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, next we're hearing from Nathan Johnson from Anchorage.
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Nathan Johnson. I am Division Manager for the Anchorage Municipal Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm here today to support SB 75 on behalf of the municipality of Anchorage and the department. I'd like to thank the Department of Health and Humans, Health and Social Services, the administration and this committee for taking on this issue. The update of the state's public health laws is one of the city's legislative priorities. As Dr. Monsager mentioned, most of Alaska's public health statutes or laws are very antiquated and were derived from and created in response to conditions that existed largely 50 years ago. In this age of global travel and increasing number of drug-resistant infectious diseases, it is imperative that we be prepared, whether it is for a bioterrorism event or the occurrence of a particularly virulent and potentially lethal disease such as pandemic flu. If a public health disaster strikes, there won't be time for the lawyers and risk assessors to sort out the extent and scope of our public health authority and powers. And again, Dr. Monsager mentioned the case of SARS several years ago that fortunately or unfortunately occurred during legislative session where a fix was able to be had. But in cases of a biological contagion and potentially lethal, time is of the essence, so it's critical that both the state and local public health be able to act quickly and decisively to address it. This bill is very important to the municipality of Anchorage as it clarifies ahead of time the extent and scope of public health powers and provides explicit due process to protect individual rights. It is important to tease out and clarify these issues before a public health disaster lands in our lap. The state of Alaska and the municipality of Anchorage work in tandem on a nearly daily basis on infectious disease surveillance, investigation, prevention, and many other public health measures. And passing this legislation will only serve to improve this relationship and further both of our abilities to work together to protect the health and well-being of the Alaskan public. And with that, I thank you and be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Does not look like it. I appreciate it very much. Any more comments from the committee on it? Let the record show that Representative Corin has joined us quite some time ago.
And I do apologize for my tardiness. I was late getting back to June on my flight just arrived about an hour ago. So thank you for your indulgence. I would just ask that the Judiciary Committee members closely scrutinize this legislation. I'm concerned about the testimony I heard from the previous gentleman, and I actually didn't get his name. Do you have that?
Yes, Nathan Johnson.
And who's he with again? ACLU?
The
one that just spoke, but before that.
Okay, that was Michael McLeod Ball with the Alaska Civil Liberties Union.
Okay. He really opened my eyes with his testimony, and I certainly would be concerned if this legislation is too general in scope and open the door to interpretations by a government bureaucracy as far as what the legislation says and interpreting things in a way that could ultimately infringe on our rights and individual liberties, particularly in the area of accessing private medical records. So I would ask that the Judiciary Committee take a close look at that, and I would also appreciate your staff forwarding the copies of that gentleman's testimony to my office as well.
Everyone on the committee will get it.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think that's one thing we need to really look at. We're going to have to find a balance in here so that we can, you know, if some kind of epidemic or some type of emergency comes, that we can move quickly like we need to, like the health community can be able to deal with this before it gets much worse, because we know in some of these instances it multiplies so quickly if we're not careful. So I am very aware of the possibility of finding that balance, and I feel very confident that when it goes to the next committee, Judiciary, that they've got people on that committee that know the laws and know exactly what they're doing. And so we'll pass it on to them, and knowing that it'll be well looked at in that committee.
Madam Chair, just another thought. I can't help but think back about the Patriot Act and how that seemed to be an overreaction to what happened with 9/11. And I just wonder if perhaps we're going down that same road with this legislation here, where it's just too comprehensive and it's just opening the door too much. And we may not be realizing what we're getting into with this bill. And I just assume I address some of these issues here at the committee level. And I, with all due respect, appreciate and respect your desire to want to move this forward. And I will not object to that, but I certainly at this point, do not support the legislation until those issues are addressed.
Okay. Representative Anderson, I think you've made comments that you will assure. Will you just state reassurance for us what you will do?
In fact, if you want me to move the bill out of committee, then Representative Corrin can object, and I'll explain my intent. Okay. So, if we're done with, are we done with public testimony? That's closed.
I believe we are.
So then, I will make a motion to move House Bill 95 as amended from committee to House Judiciary.
Object.
Representative Corrin has objected, and now we'll have some discussion.
Sure, and he stated the reasons previously to his objection, and I think with the ACLU working with Public Health Division, and I think with more scrutiny occurring at that level and by going to Judiciary, we have a pretty good time frame where we can work on this over the next month and analyze it and go section to section to see if there are constitutional issues, to see if language is too broad and we can narrow it. I believe that that by the time it gets to the floor, when your vote really counts, our votes on committee just mean it moves procedurally. It doesn't mean you endorse the bill to be enacted into law. By that time, you'll have answers. And if not, you can vote no when it goes to the floor.
Thank you.
So I'd respectfully ask, once the questions are done in discussion, that you remove your objection and you can vote no recommendation, and we can at least move it on.
And would you like to make sure you add the fiscal note to that motion?
Yes, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Pardon?
There isn't one attached.
There isn't? Maybe it's the next one that it does. I know one of them has four. So.
Yep, there is a fiscal note, zero fiscal note.
Yeah.
Component number 290.
Yes. Yes, there is one fiscal note with zero. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that I'd really appreciate Dr. Montaigne answering if it's possible, and it's that at the end of this bill are the removal of or the repealing of the 1815-149 and 1815-350, and I know that there's a good explanation for it, but it sure on the face of it looks scary, and I know that there's plans for how that gets filled in, but would you mind explaining that?
Come on forward.
Dr. Chairman Wilson, would it be okay if I asked Dan Branch to talk to what the effect is of the repeal?
Thank you. Repeal.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Branch. I'm with the Department of Law here in Juneau. Hi. Representative Sisna. Could you just restate your question again so I make sure I understand it?
Those two sections are removed, or those two, I don't know that it's a section, but statutes, or those two pieces, 18.
I believe it's on
120 are removed.
Right.
I think it's on page 24 of the bill. Line 3, is that what you're looking at?
It's the final page,
yes.
Last line.
You just want to know about the repealer and what statutes,
yes,
we're going to be saying,
yes,
goodbye to?
Putting in, and it's, yeah, line. Okay. It's actually line 15 on page 24.
Line 15 on page 22.
And I'm sorry, I should have. And it's the tuberculosis and the SARS
right.
Control programs that are being removed. And at the face of that, that looks like something we really need to be. And I know that you've got plans to make sure that we're doing that control, but I'm just wondering what that is, what the plans are, and
well,
we make sure that this bill doesn't, like, that we get another thing in place in time when this bill goes through, if you see my point.
Right. I think that I think I can assuage your concerns there. These provisions, except for the repeal of 1805, 44, and 46, all the other repealers are going to take away the current law that allows us to quarantine people for tuberculosis or SARS. SARS is 1815-350. And the tuberculosis, current tuberculosis quarantine authority is in 1815-120-149. There is one provision in 1815, in that tuberculosis section, 1815-147, that talks about religious treatment of people with tuberculosis. That's being removed because we don't need it, because people are not, under the current system, I believe they can be forced to take medication, and we're not going to be forcing people to take treatment, so we don't need to give them the option of religious treatment with isolation, which is the option provided by that statute. And while I'm here, I just want to reassure the committee that I think after working with the department in this bill, I know that they're looking for the right answer when it comes to due process and the rights of individuals, and we'd be happy to take whatever information and recommendations from the ACLU or whoever has some good ideas and look at them, so that maybe when we come back before you, will the judiciary will have a good balance that it'll be alike.
Representative Anderson?
Just for clarification, it's 1815-143 for the religious treatment for tuberculosis.
Okay,
and that's
thank
a good
you.
Clarification. No problem. I have the statute in front of me. And then also, Madam Chair, Section 1815-145, screening of school employees, will also be removed. And I read with interest, and I think I look at my fiscal conservative friend, Representative Coring, just in part, that subsection which is removed states that an employee of a public or private elementary or secondary school in the state shall be tested annually to test infectious tuberculosis, and this was done quite a while back. And some of these, I think that's where we as the health committee should look at, and I certainly endorse those. And then the other aspect, that for as much as we've kind of ranked on your legislation here, I applaud you, and now I've lost my spot, but you've added, I think you struck 1805-010, and you don't have to confirm if I'm wrong on the statute for the record, but it's the aspect or the commentary on administration of laws by the department, and then the HES department has expanded it in your legislation, and it really made it broad, and it really gave kind of a mission and measure flavor to it, and I appreciate that. And that original 1805-010 was written in 1949, so I'm glad that at least the committee endorsing some things that are making this legislation modern for the Public Health Service Division.
Madam Chair, I really wanted to do a follow-up.
Representative,
thank you very much. And I appreciate that. I want to know what's being put in place, because if you repeal it, you're taking out a program that is vital, and my own family has used that program. So, I mean, it's really important to the health of the state.
It's in the bill?
Yes, it's in the bill.
Yeah
385.
Okay, can you explain that? Great, thank you.
We're going to add Article 7. The bill adds an article for public health powers, including in that is the – oh, thanks very much. Including in that is a section for quarantine and isolation, and one also for epidemiological investigation, which would give us the authority to test people to find out if they need to be isolated or quarantined. So the tools that the old law provided will be replaced with better ones. But the department will still have the authority, if this bill passes, to use the quarantine tool that it has now.
Dr. Monsager, why don't you just pull your chair up here,
please,
too, so that you guys can both talk. And Representative Sisna, do you want to follow up?
Yeah, if Dr. Monsager would answer it as well, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman Wilson, Representative Sisna, I think the important thing about this is we've tried to take the same basic authorities we've used for TB for decades and say, what are the generalizable principles and tools we need for any and all conditions? So as we went through the drafting process from last summer through the fall, the staff that deal with TB on a weekly and monthly basis, the internal debate and critique was intense to make sure that the general provisions in this bill fit with what they do on a regular basis, with TB as the most common condition that we need to use these tools for, and to make sure that they tested the language against what they do to make sure that we don't take anything away, which I interpret as the anxiety or the question you have here, and that as we go to more generalizable language, that we have all the tools and authorities we need for any condition, and we're confident that it meets that test.
Right.
So you won't have TB or SARS or any other disease identified specifically in statute anymore, but the tools are there for any disease, and that, I think, gets to the intent of the last 15 minutes of discussion, is to the balance point for which conditions do you, of public health importance, does one need these tools for, what's included and what's excluded in the statute.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Hearing none, do we still have an objection?
I remove my objection, Madam Chair.
Okay, the objection being removed, then the bill passes on out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Didn't need it, sorry.
Okay. Now, I would like to have a motion to bring committee substitute for House Bill 105, 24/GH1081/G for consideration.
So moved.
Okay, Tom Anderson has moved the bill before us now, and it's that is under section tab 2 of your book, and we have some public testimony left over. First of all, are there any comments that anybody on the committee has left over from last week?
No.
Because we have rolled the committee substitute. We have the committee substitute before us. And we do have people online, so I will go first. We have someone off net, so I think I will take that person first. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Delisa Culpepper?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, Delisa, why don't you state your name and your affiliation?
My name is Delisa Culpepper. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Go ahead and give us your testimony.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust is wanting to speak in favor of HB 105. We are helping to fund the fiscal note on this. Dental services have been an issue for all four of our beneficiary groups for many years. We do fund some dental services through what we call mini grants already, and we're noticing a trend over the years that the mini grants are going more and more to provide basic dental services because there's no other funding for people who aren't, whether they're Medicaid eligible or lower income and aren't on Medicaid. And but our funding for mini grants isn't available in a timely manner the way people that have a dental emergency or are trying to prevent one would need. And so we have been very supportive of the department's proposal to invest in a more preventive action, realizing that it takes a little time up front to get people to a point where they aren't having these emergencies, but long term we think that it can eventually save us money and be much more humane way to provide some of our beneficiaries with the treatment they need when they don't have access to other insurance for dental. So we just wanted to speak out and say that there's a continuing need and very little other way to meet them.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for the speaker? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next, we will hear from Pamela Hawk in Anchorage. I hope I pronounced your last name right.
You did. Hawk, like the bird.
Yep, okay.
Madam Chairman, I'm here to represent Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center in support of House Bill 105. We have 9 dental operatories between the 2 dental clinics, and we see a large population of the underserved and underinsured, many of whom are Medicaid eligible. This is addressing specific to the adults with regard to Medicaid coverage, and there's a huge gap in the dental care. I'm sure much of these things were noted in the bill itself, but there's a huge gap in the dental care of the adults that are Medicaid eligible. Currently, we see, I just got wind of this, so I apologize, my data is not specific, but approximately 30 adults a week are seen at the clinic. It's around a little over 1,500 in a month. And most of those patients, because they are only eligible for emergent care, are coming in and we're pulling a lot of teeth. We're doing very little restorative treatment. They aren't able to make appointments. The bill would allow for patients to make a dental appointment, have an exam, and work on some restorative dental treatment. There's certainly a correlation, as noted in the bill as well, that there are health issues with regard to poor dental health. That's something that I think, again, can help support what we're looking at. And, again, just the access, allowing patients to be able to schedule their dental care, get on a maintenance program where they can be seen for preventive care and thwart off some of these problems that by the time we see them currently with Medicaid, adult Medicaid, we're just having to extract. So we really would like to support that bill. And I would like to be a resource as well. I can get more definitive data for you. I just did not have time to pull it when I heard about this opportunity to for testimony. So I would be more than happy to be a resource for you if need be. And I thank you for the time.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Diane DeSanto.
Hi, Representative Wilson, member of HES Committee. My name is Diane DeSanto. I'm a special assistant to Mayor Mark Begich of Anchorage. And I'd like to just say that the municipality of Anchorage is in total support of this bill. I'd like to thank the governor and the Mental Health Trust for coming forward with this. As you know, the coverage now only includes emergency dental for adults, and this bill would expand Medicaid dental coverage to include the needed services such as annual exams and x-rays, basically prevention and restorative. If the dental care is not taken care of, you know, it becomes an infection, it can lead to chronic disease and then loss of work. So it's also, in the long run, we believe that this bill will save money. The Alaska Mental Health Trust, as Delisa just mentioned, has recognized access to dental service as a priority issue for their beneficiaries, and they are willing to commit funding. Also, the matching funds from the Medicaid matching fund, so the GF wouldn't really be that much. And I think that for our city, you know, Anchorage has the largest population in the state, and this bill would benefit those citizens and, of course, the whole state, and most importantly, assist the neediest Alaskans with access to dental care. And just on a side note, this week we kicked off the Project Access, which is a medical doctor-driven health care for the uninsured. So the city is working on other ways to look at helping the uninsured. And there's over 100 doctors who are now signed up to do pro bono work. And hopefully in the future we will have dentists. So it'll be all citizens, not just the citizens on Medicaid. So I'd like to thank you very much, and hopefully this bill will pass out of your committee and pass on and see a lot. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Fairbanks. Major Richard Green.
Hello, Major Richard Green with the Salvation Army here in Fairbanks, and I do thank you for considering the bill and sending it on. I am in favor of this bill. The Salvation Army has operated a free dental clinic for the last 15 years to the working poor, those who do not have insurance or any kind of coverage that would provide dental care for them. Last year, we saw a little over 1,300 clients. We actually provided 450 in-chair appointments for these same persons. About 90% of our clients have absolutely no insurance. They're not eligible for Medicare, Medicaid. They don't have any other type of insurance. And the Salvation Army, our dental clinic, does not bill Medicare or Medicaid, so we're probably not going to receive any funds from this. But we see the bill as being a tremendous need for people who are in need of medical care and yet have no ability to pay for that or to provide for that for themselves. I think that's really all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for taking care of a lot of our people out there that we're not taking care of. So thank you very much. George Bird?
Yes, hi, this is Dr. George Bird. I'm the representing Tanana Chiefs Conference, and we want to go on record in support of House Bill 105. I'm just going to reiterate basically what a few people said earlier. The current adult Medicaid program really has deficiencies in the way that it funds adult dental services. By the time when you wait and only take care of emergency care, you quite routinely are entering in at the wrong time. Routine preventive services is the way that the dental profession has shown over the last 50 years on how to address dental needs. And the way we currently fund it, it doesn't give us that opportunity. The way this bill is being sponsored, it would allow that opportunity, and I think this would be a great step forward for the lesser fortunate members of the Alaska population.
Thank you very much. Next is Dina Summer Pettibone.
Hi, yes, I'm also with TCC, and I actually had just thanked for letting us speak on behalf of the bill. Dr. Bird pretty much covered how TCC feels about the bill and it is in support of the bill. Just that it would be a valuable service to those in need as far as self allowing them self-sufficiency and higher self-esteem.
Dina, are you also with Tanana Chiefs?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. I believe, is there anyone else online that is interested in speaking? That's all I have here. Anyone in the audience that would like to speak here in Juneau? Please come forward, go ahead and take turns and You go ahead, and then we'll get the ones in the back row.
Thank you. I'm Tom Borenstein. I appreciate the opportunity, Chair Wilson, members of the committee. I'm a dentist, and I work with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, and I'm the director of their dental services. And I just wanted to speak also in favor of this bill. I can tell you that access to dentistry in Southeast Alaska, anyway, is extremely limited for the underinsured and the uninsured. We have a lot of experience delivering services to those populations. Currently in Haines and down on Prince of Wales Island, through a HRSA grant, a federal grant, we deliver services to the uninsured, underinsured. I can tell you that the demand for those services are pretty large. Here in Juneau, on Front Street, we've last year opened a clinic that provides, in addition to other medical services, dental services to homeless population. I can tell you that we're oversubscribed the day we opened it, and we've applied for an expansion to the grant that provides those services. And I just would reiterate what a number of other folks have said about the need being out there. And I would like to just very briefly draw a parallel for you to children's Medicaid and Denali Kid Care services that have been existent in the past. And about 4 years ago, SEARCH, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, we go by the acronym of SEARCH, began a children's dental health program, and it was in conjunction with Denali Kid Care Medicaid program. And through that program, and right now there's a parallel that exists between the services that are currently available for children and expanding these services for adults, dental services. And what was what we were able to accomplish and what's taken place over the last few years with the children's program is we've been able to bring children's dentists, pediatric dental specialists to Southeast Alaska, to many of our communities, including Petersburg and Cape and Una and Angoon and Heidelberg and Plowa and Juneau and Sitka, and heretofore that those services have never been offered. And we use the reimbursements from Denali Kid Care Medicaid program to to defray most of the expenses that we incur providing those services. We provide a few thousand services for children each year doing that, and I anticipate that expanding these services for adults would have a similar benefit. So that's really all I wanted to say. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you very much. Stan DeVries? Okay. All right. Sorry about that. Marie Darlin?
My name is Marie Darlin, and I represent the AARP Capital City Task Force. And you have a letter from us already on record supporting this bill. And I don't think I want to take any of your time to repeat everything that you've already heard, which is all what we would say, too. This is really definitely needed. It's a preventive aspect that we really need to look at and saves money down the road. So we just want to add our support to the rest of them for this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that has any testimony? Please come forward. I don't think you're listed on here, so.
Okay. Well, I serve on the NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill statewide board. I had phone calls like you would not believe from all of our affiliates saying, are you going to go and tell them? Are you going to go and tell them? I said, well, I'm sure they know. As this Dr. Tom here said, that it, from the day they opened, it was there were plenty of people who have needs. My cat fell off. I can't afford it. I'm not a beneficiary. I can still work. I am a consumer, though. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill would definitely like to make a voice here that lets you know we support this totally. And things that aren't talked about that we'd like to maybe bring up are anxiety disorders give you grinding of your teeth. You know, that cracks your teeth, especially if your teeth are in bad shape because you take medication. So Leonard Abel, when I started becoming a client activist, told me that mention teeth, talk about dental. So it's in all of our face. So we support you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your testimony. Good. Have I missed anyone else? Okay, I want to make a couple comments here because I'm really proud that our department has decided to do this. I want to read a little bit here, just a couple little things that this is a printout from the Associated Press, and it says, in the past 3 years, several states have reduced adult dental coverage under Medicare, under Medicaid for budget reasons. The number of states with comprehensive dental benefits for adults, and that kind of explains one of the reasons that this is limited, and because many of the states from in the last 2 years, it has gone from 14 down to 17 states. So we know that this is going to be adding quite a lot to our HES and social services budget just because we're adding this element. But because it, in the long run, it prevents other things, this is something that we're going to do. And we do have a cap. You noticed in here, Minnesota has just dropped or just added a cap of 500 because it's so huge, the cost. So we're going to do this, and I'm excited about it, and I hope that the rest of them on the committee feel the same way, and we'll hope that it covers a lot of people but doesn't mushroom our budget too much because we know that there's a lot of need out there. So do I have any motions from the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'll disclaim a conflict of interest. Possibly I'm on the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center fundraising committee, so I presume you'll still want me to vote, but
yes,
I want to know.
I'm sorry, but okay, we need good. Your vote.
And then I will move House Bill 105, CS for House Bill 105 as amended, with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note. And in moving this, I will note, I was whispering to Representative Coring that obviously the monetary aspect concerns me, but I think the needs of the public, and in this case for dental care, the importance of it outweighs that. But I'm glad you referenced that too, because I think we shouldn't take that lightly, that obviously the taxpayer pays that burden. I so move the bill.
Do I have any objections, Representative?
I don't object. I just wanted to say thanks for those comments, and I certainly recognize the need out there, and my heart goes out to people that are in situations, whether they're elderly, low income, disabled, and they don't have the money, don't have the insurance to be able to cover these kind of services that are needed. However, the fiscal note is substantial, and I don't object to that fiscal note, but I would like to see us figure out how else we can adjust the budget, not in health and social services necessarily, but just overall to pay for that. And that's a general statement, and I'll leave it up to me to come up with some suggestions for our caucus.
Well, it is a large amount, so having heard no objections for this, then this bill has moved out of committee. So thank you. And now we have one more bill to look at today, and that is House Bill 106, Senior Care. And we changed it into a committee substitute. So this week we have committee substitute for House Bill 106 before us for consideration. And John Sherwood and Sherry Hill are here to answer any questions of the committee. Does anyone have any questions? And do we have anybody online for House Bill 106? No one online. Okay. Okay. And we have one. Marie Darlin, are you going to testify on this bill? I can't imagine why you are one that's going to be testifying. State your name and affiliation, please.
Again, for the record, my name is Marie Darlin, representing AARP, and we again want to add our support to this bill and have been aware of all the plans and all the effort put into it in order to extend the senior care that we have now, and know that it's going to get a lot of, what would you say, very good discussion before it becomes truly a new law. So we're just leaving it up to the legislature to do their very best to be able to continue this program, which we know is very important for all of our seniors who really have a need for this type of help, and know that it's somewhat complicated at times. You've heard all the presentations from the department, so you know what the need is, but we do know that there's a cost with it, as with everything else, it seems like, this session. So we're just hopeful that what finally gets through will be something that still is going to be useful to our seniors. And with that, I just urge your support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any Representative Anderson?
Not a question, a motion when you're ready.
Okay. I don't think we have anyone else. So go ahead.
I move CS for House Bill 106. With individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and presuming there's no objection, many senior homes in my district, and I know in your relative districts, members of the committee, and I think, as Ms. Darlin noted, as long as we can continue the mission in this case of helping seniors in the program without debilitating their programs, I fully endorse it.
And I believe we have, make that motion, fiscal notes. There's four
notes?
Fiscal
okay,
notes.
Plural, in the yeah. Plural, correct.
Okay. Do I have hear any objection? If not, this bill passes out of committee, and we're all excited about that. And so next week, or next Tuesday, we have, let me see if I can find my notes here. Next Tuesday at 3, we will have the committee substitute for House Bill 1, Education, increasing the amount of the base student allocation, and committee substitute for House Bill 30, another education bill, appropriation for K-12 education, and House Bill 85, prescribed medications for students when they are for newborns for their hearing. So with that, we will adjourn until next Tuesday.